Hello and welcome to the November IASB Update podcast. My name is Claire Short and I am part of the communications team at the IFRS Foundation. Today I'm joined by Andreas Barkov and Sue Lloyd, Chair and Vice Chair of the IASB respectively. And we'll be talking about topics discussed at the meeting held from the 15th to the 19th of November. Let's dive right in and start with PFS. The theme of this month was looking at management performance measures. First off, Sue, what is a management performance measure and why are they important in financial statements?
So when we're talking about management performance measures, we are really talking about a subset of what's known more commonly as non-GAAP measures. So more specifically, what we're talking about when we use that term is subtotals of income and expense that management uses to communicate with the market that aren't specified or defined in IFRS standards. And they're important, we think, to include in the notes to the financial statements because they are a useful piece of information. Investors have confirmed that. But we think it's really important that they're included in the notes so that there is discipline and rigor around the explanation of what's included in those measures, given they are being used in such a big way in the market. And at this meeting, we were talking about some specific aspects of management performance measures, and in particular, whether they need to be management's view of performance and the aspect of public communication. So the board firstly agreed to retain the objective of management performance measures as management's view of an aspect of performance. But the board also confirmed that management performance measures are provided in writing and that they are publicly communicated. And that's really important to identify the population of measures that need to be included in the note to the financial statements. And in this whole discussion, the board's trying to balance enabling management to explain its performance in the way that it thinks is meaningful and appropriate, while ensuring from our side that there's sufficient rigor to make sure that the disclosures and transparency that the board is interested in is actually provided to the market. So to reflect that balance, in relation to public communication, the board decided that it should be a rebuttable presumption that if management has provided a subtotal of income and expense in public communications outside of the financial statements, those are management's view of performance. So that's the starting presumption. However, because we know sometimes that's not the case, because, for example, a subtotal might be required to be provided by local GAAP or by a regulator, so it's not chosen by management, but rather sort of imposed or insisted upon, the board also agreed there should be the ability for a company to rebut that presumption when there's a supportable and reasonable basis for rebutting the presumption. So you start off assuming that if it's publicly communicated, it's management's view, but it can be rebutted. The board then had a discussion about faithful representation. People might remember that in the exposure draft, it was proposed that a management performance measure itself needed to be a faithful representation, and many told us that that was odd because faithful representation is a generic requirement in IFRS financial statements, so why are we singling out one measure? And the board agreed with that. So instead, the board agreed that some other sort of measures should be in place. So the basis for determining the income and expenses used in the measure needs to be explained. The definitions for terms needed to understand the management performance measures that aren't defined in IFRS standards need to be provided. And if a different basis of accounting is used in the management performance measures than is used in the IFRS financial statements, that needs to be explained as well. And also we had an important discussion about making it clear that even though we are proposing to remove the idea of specifically pointing out that a management performance measure needs to be a faithful representation, that's because not because we think that isn't relevant, but rather it's a pervasive concept. So by definition, in a way, the management performance measures need to be a faithful representation. So the communication's really important. In relation to scope, we also talked about what the form of the public communication needs to be. I also already briefly mentioned we agreed that it need to be written communication. And that is really because we didn't want people to sort of have to endlessly search for these measures to identify them for inclusion in the financial statements. And so we decided that oral communications, transcripts, and social media posts would all be excluded from the notion of these management performance measures.
Sue, that's very interesting. Can you tell us why it's relevant to include public communications in this discussion, and why aren't some forms of communications like social media included? I think you've spoken a little bit about it, but if you could just add a bit more.
Sure. So the public communications is really to try to identify the universe, and also to try to, you know, the potential scope of measures, but also to try to make sure that the measures that investors and others are relying on are, you know, in the first instance, captured for assessment, because we want to make sure there's transparency around them. But this point about social media, that was a big discussion. So, you know, it's not because we're dinosaurs. We know that some companies will communicate management performance measures or subtotals in, you know, Twitter tweets and in other social media, et cetera. And we know that happens, and it's not because we're oblivious to that it was excluded. It was really a question of sort of cost benefit. And the conclusion was that even though companies may use social media, we think it's pretty unlikely that it would be the only place where a particular measure would be communicated. We would expect it to also be included in more formal forms of written communication, and also in social media, particularly because of regulatory oversight around these types of measures. So it meant that on balance, the board concluded that for the very unusual case where we might get an extra measure picked up because it was only in social media, the benefit just wasn't there in terms of increasing the search that people needed to undertake to be sure they'd captured all of the measures. So we're trying to be reasonable as opposed to sort of thinking social media doesn't matter.
Thanks, Sue. Next up for discussion was the Goodwill and Impairment Project, which is continuing its building blocks approach to developing disclosures. That is, the board has started with general ideas and is getting progressively more specific. This month, there was a lot of discussion surrounding the pro forma statements. Andreas, can you summarize what the board was concerned about?
Sure. Pro forma is a defined term, not in our literature, but in securities laws and listing requirements of stock exchanges. Pro forma literally means as if, and describes the circumstance in which an entity is recasting its financial statements following a business combination as if the combination had taken place at the beginning of the reporting period. This is meant to give users of financial statements a meaningful starting point for time series analysis. Now, pro forma clearly is not part of what we consider to be GAAP. Our literature sets out when information communicated previously has to be recast, and usually that is the case when there has been an error or change in accounting policy. So much of the discussion centered around whether or not pro forma listing requirements should become part of our literature, obviously without becoming too prescriptive in order not to conflict with securities regulations that differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Going back to last month's technical discussion, we agreed that disclosing management's objectives for entering into a business combination and progress on meeting those objectives are generally not considered forward-looking under our conceptual framework. They're not considered so because management would present its view that existed as at the reporting date. Hence, the information is not a projection, but a fact. This month, the board discussed disclosures about synergies. And we started off with expected synergies arising from a business combination. The board tried to understand better the practical concerns. And in order to do so, we would test examples that are disaggregated one level below total synergies expected and by nature. So an entity would be expected to disclose total costs, total revenue, etc. We also will test examples that would disclose whether the expected benefits are expected to be one-offs or are expected to be achieved repetitively and perhaps even into perpetuity. As a minor point, the board decided not to define synergies because there seems to be a reasonable, profound understanding of that. We also discussed the contribution of the acquired business and decided to retain the requirement to disclose pro forma information. And there you go again. And to treat pro forma information in the same way as an accounting policy without saying it is actually an accounting policy in order not to get into that conflict of saying it is now part of our literature, because as I said before, it's considered non-GAAP. Finally, the board decided to amend its preliminary view to remove the word major from the requirements to disclose major classes of assets and liabilities assumed. This will allow the companies to use materiality when assessing these items.
Thank you, Andreas. Before we move on to dynamic risk management, can you tell us perhaps how commercial sensitivity factors into this goodwill project and how we are alleviating the concern?
Commercial sensitivity associated with disclosing such information as part of the financial statements was mentioned as a key concern by preparers in comment letters and outreaches, as well as in our Global Preparer Forum. I think nobody doubts the decision usefulness of such disclosures. They clearly provide valuable insights. However, such information has the potential of giving companies sensitive information about strategy and pricing, not only to users of financial statements, but to competitors and other stakeholders alike. And not all competitors are reporting under IFRS standards. So there is an argument about level playing field and competitive disadvantage. Management of a company has a fiduciary duty to protect the value of the company for its current shareholders and not to damage it by giving valuable information away. Now, how we can alleviate this concern is the $1 million question. Clearly, we need to be ultra sensitive when trying to strike a balance between providing useful rather than boilerplate information to the users of financial statements and acknowledging and preserving the stewardship function management has vis-a-vis its shareholders. This is exactly what we want to test with preparers, auditors, and users by providing examples to better understand where the commercial sensitivity starts kicking in.
Thanks, Andreas. Next, let's look at the DRM project, which works with hedging in interest rate risks and a company's risk management strategy. It looks at providing information to investors about banks' interest rate risk management practices using a new approach. Sue, why is dynamic risk management so important and what information can it provide?
Well, I think the short answer is that our dynamic risk management project is important because this is a core activity that banks undertake, so managing their interest rate risk and repricing risk in their banking books in particular. And investors really want to understand what they're doing and understand how good banks are at doing it and what different banks are doing and how they compare. And the challenge we have today is that hedge accounting really can't reflect this very well, not least because this type of risk management, hence the name, is very dynamic. And so what happens today is that companies really have workarounds to try and approximate a reflection of their risk management through hedge accounting, but it is a workaround. So it's not a very direct representation. And that's really what we're trying to deal with. So in this meeting, the board continued its discussion of some of the refinements that we're looking at making to the core model that people might remember we did some outreach on in the last year. And we looked at a couple of pretty technical topics. So I really recommend those who are interested look at the board papers. It's quite hard to capture this in a podcast, but I will highlight a couple of key points that were discussed at the meeting. The first is on this whole idea of a target profile. And so the board agreed to revise the definition of the target profile that we're using as a basis for the core model to include the range within which the current net open risk interest rate position can vary while still being consistent with an entity's risk management strategy, so to accommodate the risk limits that we know that people use. The board also agreed to introduce the risk mitigation intention as the new single outcome element that's used as a basis for operating the dynamic risk management model, and that the benchmark derivatives be used as the basis for representing that risk management intention, and that people look at the actual derivatives that they enter into as evidence to determine this risk management intention. So it's all very much modifications designed to link more closely with actual risk management activity. The second topic that we discussed was this sort of infamous issue of bottom layers. Again, I really recommend those interested in the topic read the paper, as the devil is very much in the detail. But the main takeaway, and the board agreed with this, is that particularly because of the addition of the risk mitigation intention to the DRM model, this issue of bottom layers is really addressed because it relates to the designation of a portion of prepayable assets in the dynamic risk management model. And because the risk mitigation intention would enable an entity to decide the extent of the current net open risk position to mitigate by using derivatives, the staff's view and the board agreed was that really this issue is already addressed through the other adjustments that we're making to the model.
Thank you, Sue. The next project that was discussed was the post-implementation review of IFRS 10, 11 and 12. This was supposed to be the last meeting for this project, but it looks set to be back on a future agenda as the board said it needs more information before making a decision. Sue, can you give us insight into what exactly the board is looking to hear from this project in a future meeting?
Yes, and this was quite a challenging meeting. I'm not sure that the staff were very happy with us at the end of it, but it happens every now and then. And so what we discussed at this meeting was really a continuation of the discussion of issues that were identified in the recent post-implementation review of IFRS 10, 11 and 12, where the staff is recommending issues that the board should consider in the context of deciding on priorities. And the idea was that these projects be considered in terms of prioritisation in the context of the agenda consultation re-deliberations. And just to give people an idea, the medium priority projects that the staff had identified for us to discuss were issues related to assisting in the application of the consolidation standard, IFRS 10, and the joint arrangement standard, IFRS 11. I'm looking at the relationship between substantive and protective rights, changes in relative activities in the life cycle of an investee for control assessments, and also how to go about assessing our non-contractual agency relationships. So we started off the discussion with the idea of thinking about identifying these topics for discussion within the context of the agenda consultation. But the discussion was somewhat inconclusive. What we did say to the staff was we wanted to understand better exactly what the scope and the size of these projects would be. So that's one thing we want to understand at a future meeting. But more generally, the discussion we had, I think, was quite interesting and an important one. And it was about how the board should think about the prioritisation of feedback from post-implementation reviews relative to how we think about projects raised in the agenda consultation. And I think the reason why this came up is it's perhaps the first time where we've had such a direct timing interaction between feedback on a PIR and an agenda consultation. So we've asked the staff to go away and think about whether we should see projects coming from PIRs and agenda consultations as being in the first instance sort of equal, or whether there's a different filter that needs to be given in the context of a PIR. So for example, because these are live application questions, do they need to be given a different order of priority to new projects in an agenda consultation? So we've asked the staff to go away, think about that, come back with a paper that helps us think about how to deal with that interaction between these two types of feedback to work out what the way forward is. And so we've all got a common understanding around the board table about how to think through the relative priorities. So watch the space.
Indeed, watch the space. And on the topic of post-implementation reviews, the board also considered when to begin its PIRs of IFRS 15, 16 and the impairment and hedge accounting requirements of IFRS 9. It has decided to begin the PIRs for the impairment requirements of IFRS 9 and IFRS 15 in the second half of 2022, but it also decided not to begin the PIRs for the hedge accounting requirements and IFRS 16 just yet. The commencement of these projects will be discussed again in the second half of 2022. Andreas, let's come back to you. The board continued its discussions on rate-regulated activities, a conversation that goes back a few months now. At the moment, the board isn't being asked to make any decisions that'll come at a later stage, but rather it's looking at the responses to the questions it set out in the exposure draft earlier this year. What did the conversation center around this month?
There were four main topics we did not cover in last month's presentation, namely a presentation, disclosure, the effective date, and any likely effects. As regards presentation, or more precisely, the presentation of a separate line item of regulatory revenue and regulatory expense, most respondents agreed to present them as a separate line item. So we got support there. On disclosures, likewise, most respondents agreed the focus of the proposed overall disclosure objective should be on information concerning regulatory assets, liabilities, revenues, and expenses. But on the effective date and transition, most respondents actually disagreed that the standard should be applied retrospectively. And most respondents asked for a longer transition period of at least 24 to 36 months. And the reason for that is that quite a few companies are currently not applying IFRS at all. So applying this standard will probably come at the same time as they become a first-time adopter of IFRS. Lastly, then, as to likely effects, most respondents agreed that the usefulness of the information provided would outweigh the cost of providing the information.
Thank you, Andreas. A plan for reassessing the project's proposals will be presented at a future meeting. So once again, watch this space. Moving on, the IFRS for SMEs project is a review of the IFRS for SMEs standard to better align it with full IFRS standards. Small and medium enterprises are generally smaller companies that don't have the resources to apply full IFRS. So the board's discussions have taken a standard by standard approach, and this month it focused on IFRS 16, which is the leases standard, as well as IAS 19 employee benefits. Sue, the board's discussions have taken a standard by standard approach with this project, and this month the discussions focused on IFRS 16 leases and IAS 19 employee benefits. Sue, I'll hand over to you to talk more about this.
Okay, sure. And I'm going to go in reverse numerical order and start with the easier one first. So IAS 19 employee benefits. So the board decided a couple of things there. Firstly, to align the recognition requirements for termination benefits with full IFRS. The board decided not to require that the actuarial gains for defined benefit plans be presented in other comprehensive income, but the board did agree to remove some of the simplifications on how a defined benefit plan is measured. So that's IAS 19. On IFRS 16, the leases standard, this was a more complicated discussion, and I think probably understandably more complicated because this was a really big area of decision for the board. So do we change the IFRS for SME standard essentially to require all leases to be brought on balance sheet in the way that IFRS 16 does, whereas IFRS for SME still has the old sort of IAS 17 style of operating and finance lease distinction. And it was a tricky discussion. The punchline is that the board decided to leave the section about leases unchanged and to consider alignment after a future review of IFRS 16 has been completed. But I think it's important to point out that that's not because the board thought that IFRS 16 wasn't relevant. Quite the opposite, in fact. The board decided that IFRS 16 was relevant for SMEs because they actually enter into a lot of leasing contracts, and we know that we believe it's useful information for users of their financial statements as well as it is for users of full IFRS financial statements. It was more a question of the costs and complexity, so the cost side of the analysis. And the board really felt that having the benefit of understanding from the post-implementation review of IFRS 16 where areas of complexity have been so that we have the appropriate simplifications for the SME community is a really important piece of information. So it's not a never decision, but rather a not yet decision in terms of alignment to IFRS 16.
Thank you, Sue. Now, turning to a different sort of project, the agenda consultation, which we have already touched on earlier in the podcast. This is really an opportunity for the ISB to hear what its stakeholders want it to add to its work plan for the next 5-year cycle. This consultation closed in September with more than 120 comment letters coming in from across the world. And this month, the board heard details about this feedback for the first time. Three main focus areas were looked at this month. Andreas, it's a very exciting project and it's a look ahead into the future. Overall, what are we hearing on what our stakeholders want us to focus on?
Thanks, Claire. I think we've heard three main themes that have come out very clearly in the feedbacks. Firstly, stakeholders have asked us not to overburden them with too many consultations, and that is in part due to the heavy load of consultations that we have had over the past 18 months, and completely understandable, and we are really appreciative for all stakeholders have done in the past. And then it's also due to the fact that we've just come out the very heavy lifting implementations of the big standards 9, 15, 16, and soon then 17. So that is understandable and has to be probably put into consideration. Secondly, stakeholders are asking us to keep in mind the connectivity between us and the recently announced International Sustainability Standards Board and to accommodate opportunities for the two boards to work together in our new work plan. It's worth reminding that when we put out the agenda consultation document, the ISSB was not yet in existence. So it doesn't come as a surprise that close to the end of the comment period, that more and more stakeholders actually took the current developments on board and said, you really need to set aside capacity for working with the new board. And thirdly, and very much to my liking, they're asking us to do some work in the area of intangibles that I have spoken about publicly before. Now, let's get back to what we heard specifically at the November board meeting. Our discussion focused on three main areas, as you said, and I will touch on each on these individually. Part one was about the current allocation of the board's existing six activities, being new projects, review of new standards, IFRS for SMEs, digital financial reporting, understandability and accessibility of the standards, as well as stakeholder engagement. I'd say many respondents said that the current allocation of resources to the board's six main activities is about right. Obviously, not everyone agreed with that, but that was a majority. Many said the board should set aside capacity to respond to emerging issues in a timely manner. And likewise, many emphasized the increasing importance of sustainability and commented on a potential interaction between the IASB and ISSB, as I alluded to before. The second part around the criteria used to evaluate potential new projects, most, I would say, almost all agreed with the criteria proposed by the board. Many said that the criteria are well-balanced and adequate. And some said that they would like to understand better how the criteria will be applied to individual projects. But the question really is, can we do much more without becoming too mechanistic in that part? Then thirdly, onto the topics for new projects. And I should just put a caveat in here that we haven't seen the entire feedback around projects. So this was just a high-level summary. But the message that emerged from that, or projects that respondents put a high priority on, were climate-related risks, cryptocurrency and related transactions, intangible assets, going concern, pollutant pricing mechanisms, and the statement of cash flows. And as said, the board will continue to discuss the feedback at future meetings.
Andreas, this looks like we're being asked to accomplish quite a bit. How can we manage expectations on what we can do to try to get as much done as possible?
That's a fair question. I think it is useful to remind our listeners that the purpose of the agenda consultation was not to reset everything to zero from January 1st, 2022, and have solutions at hand by the end of 2026. The board has an active agenda and we are committed to finish the projects on it unless we receive strong messages that the priorities have changed significantly, which from all I've seen does not seem to be the case, but we will be hearing more about this in December. I expect that we will continue working on our existing agenda throughout 2022 before we can actually devote meaningful board and staff time to take on any new significant projects. Some of the areas that I mentioned, we will need to assess how much of that actually is for us to take on and how much there is for the new ISSB or for both of us to consider. If I take climate-related lists and pollutant pricing mechanisms as an example, it seems that there may be something for both boards to consider, separately or jointly, but in any way connected. There's also work that we need to do as per our due process handbook that you mentioned before, which are the post-implementation reviews. The board is asked to carry out a PIR for any major standard or amendment 2 or 3 years after the new requirements have become effective. Now, if you look back, that would mean that IFRS 9, 15 and 16 are surely candidates in that regard. And our listeners will recall that we have in fact started the first phase of our PIR on IFRS 9, which is currently out for consultation. What we have yet to establish is what, if anything, we do with the feedback we receive and how we factor the results in as regards prioritization, especially in relation to the agenda consultation, as Sue said before. So in a nutshell, there's a lot to do, but we will make sure we take our time and do not compromise quality in due process.
Thank you, Andreas, and thank you to both of you for joining me today. Before we sign off, a little bit of other news that we can recap. The IASB published an exposure draft earlier this month that proposes amendments to IAS 1, which is the presentation of financial statements. Stakeholders with this consultation are being asked to comment on proposed narrow scope amendments that are aimed at improving the information companies provide about long-term debt with covenants. The board also published a second exposure draft. This happened in late November, and this consultation relates to proposed changes in disclosure requirements to enhance the transparency of supplier finance arrangements and their effects on a company's liabilities and cash flows. With that, we wrap up this month's episode. You can catch up on previous episodes of this, as well as the IFRS Interpretations Committee podcast, on our website, as well as on our YouTube channel and on Spotify. If you like this podcast, please take some time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. And until next time, keep well.